Welcome to the Automotive Diagnostic Podcast. We're going to explore ways to sharpen our diagnostic skills, find learning resources, and hear from experts in the automotive field. Hey, have you ever been faced with the challenge of sourcing, installing, and programming a used control module in a vehicle? I know a lot of us have. It seems to be happening more and more often today with the volume of control modules on vehicles, the cost of some new ones, or even the availability of new control modules. In some cases, used may be the only option. So what do you do here? I strongly recommend checking out SJ Auto Solutions and Tommy Oliva. Tommy offers a cloning service for used control modules to make these things plug and play for the vehicle that you're working on. In a lot of cases, he is also able to source the control modules if you're unable to locate one for the vehicle that you're working on. But once you get connected with Tommy, he's going to offer fantastic support from start to finish to make sure that that control module is going to work in your application. He's also got tech support that he offers through his website, along with some free resources there as well on information about used control module programming. So make sure to check out SJ Auto Solutions. I can't recommend that enough. I am happy to have Automotive Seminars as a sponsor for the show. Now, if you're not familiar, Automotive Seminars is a diagnostic technician training company. They've got a website that there'll be a link to in the show notes. And what they offer is top-notch training to technicians like us in the field. I've been taking their training courses for years and have got a ton of benefit out of it. They've got top-notch instructors, John Thornton, Scott Shotton, Scott Manna. And every other month, they've got a two-night course that you can sign up for. Join in, ask questions, and afterwards, you've paid for the course, you can access a recorded version whenever you want. You can rewatch the class 2 years later in case you wanted some details on it. And that is a fantastic feature. So make sure to check out the website to see what courses they have available and what's coming up in the future. Hey, what's going on, automotive world? Welcome to another episode of the Automotive Diagnostic Podcast. My name is Sean Tipping, and I will be your host once again for today's episode. Thank you so much for joining me. Today on the show, I've got Zach McLean joining me. He's been on the show several times before. Good friend of mine, awesome mobile tech locksmith. Today, we are going to be talking about the other side of the table in regards to the NASTIF conversation. If you listened to last week's episode with Tanner Brandt, and I suggest you do that either before or after you listen to this episode, we're really going to be taking the other side of the discussion, debate in regards to the NASTIF email that was sent out about VSPs and locksmith immobilizer type tools. Now, obviously, if you've been online, you talked about this with anybody, there are some strong opinions both ways, right? A lot of different perspectives out there. And it seems like a lot of people are fairly entrenched in one side or the other. But what I thought is really important is to have both sides of the discussion, not just to fixate on one, even if I think one side or the other is correct, or if I lean that direction, I still think it's important to hear the concerns of the other side, the other perspective, because that's the only way that we make an overall improvement is if we hear from, you know, all of the professionals in this field, our peers who are doing the same or similar things as us, and, you know, at least consider the concerns that are regarding the things that are happening, right? That's the only way that we can really improve things and make them better. So that's why I'm having this discussion. So you might agree with some of the things that are talked about on today's episode. Maybe you don't. And maybe you felt that way last week. Maybe you didn't agree with some of the things we were saying. And there are some strong opinions in this episode. But again, I think it's important to get that stuff out there. So listen to this with an open mind. And again, check out the episode from last week with Tanner. And then you can make a decision for yourself where you stand on this. But either way, it was great talking to Zach, and I really appreciate him sharing his honest opinion. So with that out of the way, let's jump into the episode. Awesome. Cool. Well, good evening, Zach. How's it going?
It's going, man. Dying from the sickness, whatever I have.
Yeah, it's going around. I know a couple people, and kids are sick, and yeah, it's that time of year. It happens.
Yep.
You were sending me the link to a new house that you just bought. I was actually just scrolling through the pictures right before we hopped on here. That's pretty cool, man. Congratulations.
I'm stoked. I didn't know how I would ever buy a house without selling a kidney on the black market and other shady
Especially
things.
Nowadays, yeah.
Yeah, and only 6.6% interest. Woo, what a deal in today's market. Which, actually, it was the lowest rate we could get, and it was lower than a lot of the quotes, so...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it, I mean, it, compared to you know, 6-7 years ago, yeah, you know, it's double whatever, but talk to people who bought a house in the 80s or something like that. And, you know, it's not too bad. I think when I got my first one, it was 5 and some change. And, you know, eventually refinanced and stuff, but it's so worth it, to get into your own place and establish yourself. And it's just you and your wife. You don't have kids, right?
Nope. Just the cat that you can see right there.
Fur babies. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Awesome. When's the closing? When you move in?
So April 10th should be our closing. Had the inspection today. Inspection went well, found a lot of little things. Hopefully we can negotiate with, especially in, like we said, the market, hopefully we can get some more off. But yeah, all things going well from this point out. I will be a homeowner officially as of April 10th.
That's awesome. And then, yes. Yeah. And then the work will never end. There's that part of it, but it's totally worth it,
man. I try to stay professional, not use mechanic shop talk, but it's like having a shitbox car. There's always something broken, and I love the shitbox yep. life. I drive them. So it's going to be like another shitbox in the fleet, man. I'm just going to work on it. So,
yep. There will always be a project. Like, and as soon as you finish one, oh, okay, well, now that's broken. Or, I mean, even if you get all the broken stuff fixed, then you're like, well, I want that better. And this next project comes around. And yeah, it's good, though. I mean, you spend, you know, a decade or so in a place and really put a lot of effort into making it yours. And especially if you're doing the work and building stuff up, it is really cool to have your own place that you've set up the way that you want. So yeah, I'm happy for you. That's so cool.
Thanks, man. I'm still sitting on the edge of my seat until April 10th. I'm going to be not believing any of this is real. So
yeah. Yeah. You sign a stack of paperwork about this tall and you feel like you signed your life away, but
30 years.
Yep. Yep. Cool. Well, what else is going on? How's business?
How's Man, school? Well, that's another discussion. So I had to take a break with the house situation. We knew we wanted to get into a house so we could, you know, have a fixed housing cost because rents are skyrocketing where I live. If you just type in Google Fayetteville, Arkansas rental, you will find news story after news story after news story about how our rates have increased higher than almost anywhere in the entire country. So financially, it was really difficult to continue to pay for school. I don't do debt. I try to avoid it at all costs up until the house. And so I've been very skittish about getting a student loan and doing things that way because it's been a while since I was in school and I was struggling with some of my math classes. So I decided, you know what, time out, focus on business, focus on making money. Let's get into a house. I've already waited this long, so it's not like a year or two extra is really going to make the big of a deal. But I've really got to streamline some business operations, change. I may stop doing retail keywork, because that is the biggest time waster, time sink that I've ever done. It makes great money. It's just constant texts, phone calls, haggling. It's not worth the effort. And probably narrow my customer list down to just the shops that don't try to price shop me, the ones who see the value in my product and are more relational than transactional. And then once I do that, I can focus more on school and just putting the business on autopilot. Again, tech shortage, all the tech shortage. I would love to expand, and I have hit a point where I'm kind of tapped out, but there's really nobody I would feel comfortable recruiting, and I'm going to potentially anger a lot of my customers, because who's the technician base I'm going to recruit from? My customers' technicians. So that's a slippery slope.
We're possibly looking for another van going in June, and that by far is the toughest part, is like who is going to fill those shoes, because it is slim pickings out there. Just, I mean, of people who want to do it, and then you got to find somebody who's skilled enough and has the right attitude, and you know, there's only so many unicorns out there, so I don't know if I'll be able to find one, but yeah.
You got to be a unicorn in this business, man. Doing mobile, it's like the heavyweight division. You get beat to death every single day. Don't get me wrong, the guys that do R&R and do brakes and tires, and they're just as important as we are, and their job isn't easy. But man, you've got to be a jack of all trades and an expert in many to do this. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty difficult.
Yeah, you almost have to be like a glutton for punishment, in a sense. Like in the depths of your soul, you kind of like getting your ass kicked a little bit. And then you're perfect for mobile.
If you can't quit, if you're someone that finding the answer to a question is far more important than will it make me money, you probably fit in pretty well in the mobile crowd.
Well, that's cool. I mean, I'm glad it's going good for you. Are you still running that little red Transit that you bought?
Yeah. I jokingly tell everyone you don't own a Transit Connect until you own two, because they always have transmission troubles. It was a nightmare. I had a transmission failure after the first failure when I purchased the vehicle. So I have two of them, and the red one's been back on the road like 4 or 5 months now, I think. It's been a while, but I'm refusing to sell the other one, because as soon as I sell it, I'm going to lose the overdrive, and it's going to be done, third, fourth, gun. So...
Well, not knock on wood. I just hit 300,000 in mine the other day, and she's going strong. But I know I'm on borrowed time on that thing. And actually, there's an oil leak I gotta address, because I was like, oh boy, here we go. It's time. So eventually, I'll move on. We actually the next week I'll be signing a lease for a space, and it's small, but it is finally the door to me potentially getting a taller van, because my garage at home has been my limit. I can't get anything taller than a Connect because it won't fit in my garage and it can't be outside in the winter here. But we're actually going to have a small garage space and office space. It's kind of like home base for the business, and the garage is tall enough. I'm like, okay, well, maybe I'll look into something bigger. But I really do love my little Transit Connect. I mean, it has been, again, knock on wood, it has been pretty dang bulletproof for me doing this mobile thing for 4 or 5 years.
I totally agree. Think it's the best starter mobile van on the entire planet, all of its flaws included. You cannot beat it for the price.
Yeah, well, and just like a house, like I have it set up the exact way that I want it, right? I got all the shelving set up. I've got the inverter set up. I got a power strip in back, so I can just, I have all my laptops in the van. So I used to pull them all out every night. Nope, it's in the van. I just plug in the van at night. And so if I get another van, you got to spend all the time getting it set up and everything like that. I'll send you a picture. So my inverter, it goes between the two seats. In the front there, I have a cage, right? And I just kind of like strapped it to the cage. So it's sitting up like this.
And it's in the perfect location, so I got a sticker that's a flux capacitor. I just slapped it on the front. I'm like, it already kind of looks like it, so I put the sticker on there. So, I mean, it's just for me, but I enjoy it every time that I get in the van. So,
adding your personal touch. Like you said, it's like home, man. Like, I spend as much time in that van as I probably do at home. So, I mean, I put stickers from all my friends on the back shelving or the back side of the shelving in my van. So every time I open the doors, I get that little pep talk. If my friends are out here getting their teeth kicked in, I can do it too. So those little personal touches do make a difference.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Cool. Well, what are you thinking about NASTA? If you want to dig into that a little bit?
Yeah.
Popular subject right now.
So I'm definitely in the opposing viewpoint crowd. I'm not happy about it. I'm pissed is probably the best word. Let me just start by saying I am a credentialed VSP. I have been since, I think, 22. I'd have to go back and look. I've had it for a long time. So this isn't going to affect me directly, but I'm very, very against it, and I think it's a joke, to be quite honest. I've spoken to many friends, and I've tried to be open to the pro side of the argument as well. My buddy Isaac told me, you know, hey, this could be a gateway for us getting into keys that you can't do with aftermarket equipment because the OEs don't share info. So if we play the little game and join their little secure club, maybe they'll allow us access to doing key programming. Yeah, I'm a little cynical about that. I'm a cynic, but you know, that is a potential positive. So I would just like to air out my negative feelings about it and air out some of the things that I think are obvious and let the end user decide. Do you want to take the dark side, the anti-NASTIF approach, or do you want to join the cult of everyone should be a VSP? So
that's I definitely wanted to have, you know, the other side of the table, Tanner on here last week, and you know, obviously discussion was like a pro, you know, NASTIF and why this is a good thing. And I agree with a lot of those points, but at the same time, like I mentioned last week, there's a number of people in this industry that I respect, like yourself, that have made some, you know, solid counter arguments and points. And I believe it's really important to get, you know, both sides out there. And so kind of wanted to do that, you know, on the show so that anybody listening, you know, can hear both perspectives and, like you say, make the decision for themselves, which direction, you know, they'd like to go or what they want to support or how they want to approach doing key work in the future. So, yeah, I don't know where exactly you want to start with it, but I'm down to chat about whatever.
Well, first, anyone that's listening, I'm not exactly famous. I don't have clout, but I want to try to prove my credibility, right? So I've been an auto technician it'll be 11 years in April. I've been doing mobile work that includes full service automotive locksmithing for 3 years, and this October it'll be three. So I've been in it a bit. I apprenticed under a sole locksmith. He didn't do any programming as we mobile guys would see it. So I've kind of seen both sides of the fence. I've been in the locksmith community and I've been in the automotive repair community. Again, I'm a credentialed VSP. And in future points that I'm going to make in this episode, my brother is getting his PhD in May, and it's in computer engineering, and his specialty is in software and hardware security. So I had some interesting discussions with him, and he had his own doubts and comments. So I'm not just some rando that's on a Facebook group. Oh, NASTIF's bad. Don't be a VSP. This is the end of the world, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a pretty reasonable guy. I don't like to be conspiratorial. And I've been in the industry long enough. I've kind of seen ploys like this come out and ideas like this try to be rolled out, and they failed miserably. So I would like to speak not only from experience, but from a level of, you know, credibility. You know, take what I say with a grain of salt, but I'm not just some rando that's out here on the Autel IM508 Facebook group running their mouth.
There's a few of those.
Oh, my goodness. A ton of those. Let's not go down that road.
And that's exactly the type of person I want to talk to, who is out there doing this stuff every day and understands the industry, you know, from our perspective, like most of the people listening to this show are out there fixing cars, doing this stuff every day. And so how is this going to directly affect me and my job or my business? Right. Because like, I'm not on the NASDIF board, you know, I'm a member, I'm a VSP, you know, credential. I've got that. And I got it when I started my business so that I could, you know, do these, you know, transactions. And I actually looked the other day, and I think in the time that I've had it, I think I got it in 2020. I've maybe used it 10, 15 times in that. Granted, those cars, like they're probably unlikely any other way that I would have gotten those particular vehicles done. Outside of some real crazy stuff. But I mean, that was the way I got those done, and it was good to have. And I'm glad they're there. I'm glad they, you know, that there is that connection. But, you know, I do see the other side of it too, of like, I don't need things to make my job more complicated when I'm just trying to fix cars, right? Like, and we've been looking at it now of like, okay, because I got three IM tools for Autel. Like, we use those all the time. We do a lot of keys and stuff. And so now I'm looking at this, like, how are we going to structure this, and how is it going to affect our day-to-day business, right? Because I'm, at the moment, I'm the only credentialed member of the team, and we got three guys. So I need to, you know, get them on sub accounts or figure out, you know, how that's going to work if we're starting to use these, you know, as a VSP credential tool. I realize it's not filing a D1 every time, but like, I assume I can't just like give Steve my login and say, yeah, go ahead and make some keys. Like, that doesn't work that way. That's not the idea behind this. So, you know, it's creating some extra work for us for sure, which I'm in the works of getting all that figured out.
Yes, same here. Thankfully, I'm a single man show, so I don't have to worry about getting sub accounts and things like that. But it's kind of a scary change for a lot of people. I am friends with many locksmiths in my area. Two of them, actually three, are really, really great friends. And I have three people using me as their, what's the reference? That's what it is. Sorry, the brain fog. They're using me as their reference for their VSP credential application. You know, I'm happy to do that. I want to see more people get involved with NASDIF. I want to see more people get their VSP credential because, like you said, those cars that nobody else can fix, program, whatever, sometimes you hit a brick wall and there is sadly no other option. But thankfully we have the, you know, NASDIF transaction system that we can resort to. And I say resort because it's always my last thing. I never want to use it if I can avoid it. But we have that to fall back on, and we have them in our side of the ring fighting for us to have access to these, you know, OE software scan tool combinations and service information and things of that nature. So I'm right on board with you on it.
What's the, I actually don't know or haven't talked to any locksmiths about this. Do you know, what is the general opinion, or at least the people that you know, about something like this?
So it depends on the locksmith you talk to. The guy I apprenticed under, his name's Brad Boyd. Excellent guy. He's an amazing locksmith. Jokingly call him Brad the Lock God. I mean, he is well known, I think, in the locksmith community for his skill set and his willingness to help others. I have never met someone that is against the VSP system other than me, more so Brad. He's against it as much as me, if not more. And okay, the opposing side, which a lot of locksmiths are definitely against it, the opposing side is, yippee, this is going to kick my competitors out of the market, which is kind of a half truth. But instead of, you know, critically thinking about what this change will do to their business, their first reaction is, yay, less competition, let's drive up prices. And I'm not against charging a fair rate for what you do, and you shouldn't do it for too cheap, but they're cheering on the demise of other people rather than trying to look at this system and analyze, is this actually going to do what it is touted to do, and how is this going to work? And that's kind of sad, but those are the two camps that I've run into, and there's a huge split in my groups, probably 50-50.
So it's not just a barrier for the sake of there being a barrier. You're looking at it being something effective to what they're trying to accomplish or attempting to accomplish with it, right?
Yeah, there's the attitude of we hate the trunk slammers, we hate the hacks. And don't get me wrong, man, I really hate it when I have to go clean up a mess that another, air quotes, locksmith created. And there's some really great guys around me, and there's some people around me that shouldn't be doing this. And I have had to clean up some messes that they've created. So I totally understand the disdain for the unskilled and the cheap guys. But this system isn't going to get rid of them, and they're still going to be here. And if your sole purpose for liking it is to cheer on the demise of your competitors, that just, it's a bad look, in my opinion.
So, well, let's get into the idea behind it, at least from what I have seen, is to help reduce vehicle theft and to help prevent theft of tooling from technicians and shops. And unless there's something else, that's what I saw was from NASDIF or the people involved with NASDIF. That's why this was put into place. As far as those two things go, I mean, what are your feelings on the effectiveness of something like that? Do you think it's going to help with either one of those?
Well, again, I hate to use shop language, man, but this is a load of horse shit. It's not going to stop theft. It's not going to stop theft of tools. People are going to bust windows out. They're going to pry doors open. They're going to hold people at gunpoint for whatever they have, whether it be a wallet, a cell phone. I mean, just because your iPhone has a secure Apple ID doesn't mean that it won't get stolen, shipped off to China, and then unlocked at a board level. So spare me the lip service, okay? This isn't going to prevent theft. It isn't going to prevent theft of tooling, and it's not going to prevent theft of cars. This is a voluntary system, so that means that the scan tool manufacturer has to agree to join it. And again, I'm not at the board level of NASDIF. I haven't been involved in these conversations, so there might be some factual inaccuracies. But to the best of my understanding, it seems like if you don't play ball, you lose access with ETI, right? And yep. I don't want to go into a huge spiel about ETI, but that's how a lot of these scan tool manufacturers get information to build their tools, like what address line does this module belong to, or what's the address of it, and what do these headers on these messages mean, so that they can build their scan tools without having to start from scratch, right? But let's be real. The Autels and Launches and X-Horses of the world exist in China. And when's the last time China played by the rules and wasn't stealing right. everyone's intellectual property? You go set up shop in China, the first thing that's going to happen is the CCP is going to come in and steal all your IP. So tell me again how this voluntary system is going to incentivize these manufacturers to do it. It's more so about money and their ability to sell in the US, because I'm sure that there's probably going to be a lot of agencies at the federal, state, and local levels that are like, hey, we want to put rules in place to not let these tools be sold because car theft, right? But yeah, it's voluntary, air quotes.
Well, that is something that I was wondering is, yeah, voluntary. And obviously, Autel sells a ton of tools. And specifically, when we look at the key world, those IM tools and the KM100s and, that stuff is everywhere for sure. They sold a lot of those things. And if, at least the way I looked at it, this is going to be a reduction in sales for them, because there's going to be a lot of people who can't do anything with a KM100 if they need a VSP credential. It's going to be somewhat of a pointless tool at that point, besides a few functions. But so that's a hit to the sales for Autel. So then it makes me consider, okay, well, why would they choose to do this? And I think what you're getting at is probably correct, is they want to be able to sell their tools in the US, some sort of, like you say, authoritative crackdown from the government or some agency like that. That is the thing, is it's based in China, and I mentioned it last week. Obviously, they've definitely stolen a lot of software. I mentioned first the 708 that I used, the DS-708 Autel, is the first one I bought, and I was blown away at the functions that I had on that tool. But they got sued over that like crazy, because I think one of their versions, you could program GMs with it, like literally program GMs with that thing when it first came out, because they just copied and reverse engineered everything out of every tool. So I don't know. Do you think there's going to be any reduction in that? Like specifically from Autel, obviously we have no idea, but is something like this going to actually reduce that amount of that stolen software if they're now part of this partnership?
Absolutely not. I mean, look at every single industry in China. They all steal. They've stolen from Boeing. In fact, I was watching a cool little mini short documentary last night about IP theft and China's corporate espionage. And these guys will not give up. It's their military that is basically funding and facilitating these organized attacks on everyone. They stole, what, 22 million, I believe? Again, fact check me, listeners. Don't believe anything I say. But around 22 million documents from the federal government, I believe, where they had stored like applications for security credentials. These guys are, they've got a vacuum and they're sucking up every bit of information they can get. Okay, Autel China and Autel US are probably two separate entities as far as the U.S. government and the Chinese government are probably concerned, right? And I'm sure Autel China could care less about these rules because they don't sell, quote unquote, they don't sell their tools here, right? It's Autel US who you're supposed to buy tooling from through authorized distributors, right? I think a good thing, and this was mentioned to me by a few people, is this is probably going to cut down on all of the gray market, Oceania, China market tools that are sold on eBay and Amazon, which is a huge thing.
Yeah.
That makes me happy because Joe Homeowner isn't going to get the IM608 car killer, is my favorite nickname for it, and start bricking all of the stuff in his car and screwing stuff up. All the amount of cars you can mess up with it. That's great news for us. However, it's not going to prevent the massive issues we have with car theft.
So looking at an organization like NASTIF and what they're potentially capable of doing, is there a more effective way to approach something like this in your mind? Now, again, like I start to think about stuff like that. I'm like, me personally, Sean, I'm not qualified to figure all that out, but I am curious to know, like, what are other people's thoughts on that as far as like, how could something like this be more effective in order to prevent car theft? Because that would be, pretty top of the list for me too. Obviously, I don't want my tools stolen, but I guess I kind of put that more on myself, of like, okay, I need to protect my personal property the best that I can. But the car theft thing, what could they do to make this better?
Well, I definitely don't like the federal or state or local governments, right? They find the most inefficient, backwards, expensive ways to fix problems, but there's oversight that all of us as citizens have. You can call your city council person. You can call your state senator or state congressman. You can call your federal senator or congressman. Good luck getting them to do anything, but at least you can feel like I have a way to get a hold of them. And the reason I bring this up is I think the only logical reason, and again, I'm just some random guy that goes around and makes car keys and programs modules. Who am I to, dictate how this should be fixed? But maybe controlling the point of sale, right? Controlling access to the device itself would be better. Purchasing firearms at the federal law level, every state's a little different. You have to fill out a form, and it's an ATF form 4473. You have to answer a bunch of questions, provide photo identification, and they record the serial number of the firearm on the form. And there is a record of the transaction taking place on top of verifying that the person who's purchasing it is capable and is legally allowed to own it, right? Maybe if we created a system like that to control the point of sale, we could reduce the amount of car thieves going out and buying these tools. Because truly and honestly, man, I run around a lot of these locksmith groups. I don't think the tool theft issue, at least now, is as big as it has been. And I think a lot of these guys are probably ordering cheap key tools from eBay or Amazon, and they're going out there and, stealing cars, lifting them as quickly as they can. So if we could control the point of sale, that would be, in my opinion, the most efficient way to do it, because now once you have it, it's yours. There's no online requirement. I live in a rural area. If you expect me to get online, and I've heard the 24 hours of access stuff, right? I've heard it all. But when I go out in the sticks in rural Arkansas, I may not have turned that tool on in 3 days because I've been using other tools. Sure. And now I'm stuck. I've got a, you know, single mom who needs her car, and she's not going to get to drive her car because we have these dumb rules that are, you know, virtue signaling. They're all about image. They're not actually about preventing theft. And this poor lady's inconvenienced. I've wasted fuel and nothing was fixed except me being a rule follower. I've been inconvenienced and the customer's been inconvenienced. So I think point of sale is probably the best way to do it. But again, that's a whole different can of worms. Letting the government control something, it's pretty scary. And
yeah, I've been to the DMV. I know how government run operations go.
It doesn't operate. It doesn't run. That's the sad part of that idea.
They don't have any competition and very little incentive to do better. That's where, and I'm fully on board with you there for sure. I want as few regulations, you know, from the government as much as possible. And I guess that's where I personally like an organization like NASTIF. And maybe I personally have, you know, some privilege there because of the people I know. But that's the thing, is like, I know these people, or some of them, not all of them, but I've met them. I see them at trade shows. I can interact with them. Now, not that that's going to change anything for me personally, but I guess I just like to know that, okay, I actually know some of the people that are making these decisions, where I don't know if it's the government. Like you say, yeah, you could call your senator or you can vote and stuff like that. But you can go to the NASTIF meetings as well. They have those committee meetings and stuff like that. And there's the option to voice your concern. So, I mean, I guess that part of it I definitely like, but yeah, it's, so your thought is to regulate how you get the tool in the first place and then what you do with it after no one's watching over your shoulder.
Well, I mean, let's come back to the firearms example, right? Someone busts into my house and I haven't taken the time and tried to secure my firearms and I've made them easily available, it's my fault that that person was able to access my firearm and use it, correct? Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah.
So me as a security professional, not only from the title of VSP, but I deal with security all day, every day. It is my responsibility to secure my tooling and to make sure it's safe, right? Yep. And it's a personal responsibility thing. I'm one of those horrible people that thinks it's the person's responsibility to make sure things are fixed, not a group like NASTIF or the government. But you should be doing what it takes to keep your equipment safe. Not going on service calls at midnight into a bad neighborhood. That's probably a good idea. I don't typically get my tools out if I feel like there's something up. Things of that nature, because that would probably help cut down on theft.
I fully agree with that, for sure, 100%.
On the other side of that coin, I have a really good locksmith friend. His name's Eric, and I'm gonna destroy his last name. So, Eric, if you do end up listening to this, please correct me again. I think it's Demers. He teaches courses for American Key Supply. He is a really good locksmith, and I truly believe that he is on that cusp of learning the things that we as technicians know so that he can do a better job in locksmithing. He has a van, and he had, like, the master lock padlocks that are recessed over his doors. He has a facility that's behind a fence, I believe. I'd have to go back and look at the pictures. And he's in LA. His van got busted into. They literally pried the doors open. And once they got in, they stole everything. We're talking probably tens of thousands of dollars just in keys alone. All of his equipment, Autel IM608, you know, probably a Smart Pro, like all the stuff he had. So they basically got a free ticket to car theft. And that guy was making every effort to prevent theft from happening. So I understand the people that are in the cult of let's create regulations and rules are probably going to be like, oh, well, you didn't think about this. I did. And I'm trying to be reasonable about it. But I don't think extra rules and, you know, hamstringing people who are already doing the right thing is the solution.
Yeah, and it's not going to, the thing is, I will agree with this side of things, it's not going to stop people from stealing stuff, right? Like, that's, people are going to do shitty things. That's never going to stop. And on that side of things, maybe it's more about the punishment for crime theft, which has nothing to do with us, right? That's outside of the automotive world. But as far as increasing what's going to happen to you if you're caught doing this stuff. Me personally, I think that's going to be the number one way to help prevent, not eliminate, still going to happen, but to reduce the amount that this happens.
You can't legislate morality, man. It doesn't matter. Right. We have laws against murder. Did that magically stop murder overnight? Absolutely not. We have laws against theft. Didn't stop the thefts, right? Everything's incentive-based. Yep. Everyone has an agenda. I don't care who they are. I have an agenda, man. I don't want to have the tool connected to the internet if it's not an internet-required function. I don't want to have to worry about whether or not someone's going to come in and audit me and find the one car that I screwed up on, because we're all human, make mistakes. And then this entity that I don't feel I have as much ability to speak for myself, which I have to say, I've spoken to Donnie. I respect him as a person. He seems like someone who truly cares. But I'm just one guy in the sea of this entire industry, and it takes is one mistake. When you're a VSP, you have to take this very seriously. And I can't afford to lose the credential as it sits now. Imagine that tens of thousands of dollars of my equipment is basically being held hostage over my head by this third party who I have no direct control over, in my personal opinion. And all it takes is one little mistake. They're the boogeyman, right? Donnie's not under your bed, guys. Don't check. But I mean, it's very scary as someone in business that now not only do I have to worry about being on the right side of the law, but if something happens outside of my control and that car can be traced to me, now I have to worry about losing that credential. And I truly believe that NASTIF would stand up for their VSPs. They're not going to try to railroad us, but it's still a scary possibility to lose access to all that equipment over something as small as you duplicated a key, for example, and that car ended up being stolen. That's a great story I'd love to segue into, but I don't want to derail the conversation.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we can definitely go that route. I don't like the idea of losing the functionality of the thousands of dollars of equipment that I have. If something were to happen, of course, now, again, personal responsibility, that's on me to now be very particular about what I'm doing and how I do it. But yeah, like you say, stuff still happens, right? And we've heard a lot of those stories, and maybe that's one of them that you got, that like you do everything right and then it's still some sort of goofy situation. We mentioned Cody on here last week, where, you know, it's a ex-boyfriend and his name's on the insurance and this and that. And yeah, stuff happens even when you're trying to do everything as right as possible.
Yeah. And let me be clear. I want to preface this by discussing how it works where I live. So in the state of Arkansas, thank God we don't have locksmith licensing, because then again, another way for your livelihood to be held hostage. And because of that, it's really the Wild West out here as far as car keys are concerned. But regardless of that, I have always D1 form, no D1 form, mechanical key, transponder, prox. It doesn't matter. If you lose all your keys, you're not getting one from me unless you provide me a government-issued photo ID, which really should be a driver's license, a proof of ownership document, and I do not accept insurance. It better say the state of Arkansas, state of Oklahoma. It's got to be government documentation with your name and your address. All that information's there. I take a picture of it, and I attach it to my invoice, so I cover my customer and I cover me, right? That customer is confident that their car is being, you know, all keys lost services being taken care of, and I'm verifying their, you know, ownership. And a lot of people are very happy to do that. And I'm covering myself. So in the future, if something does happen, the police show up or NASTIF calls me and say, hey man, absolutely, let me go ahead and show you those documents, because I don't want to help people steal cars. I've had stuff stolen. It makes my blood boil. But let's just talk about reality. Have you ever done an ADA key? You ever cloned a transponder chip? And that's not going to have this system involved with it. But that's what a lot of hardware stores do. You take your, you know, 2006 Chevy Impala, for example, right? It's a B111 PT, I believe is a part number. That's a Circle Plus 46 transponder. You take the key into the hardware store, they cut the key, and then they clone the chip, right? You walk out with a key. Did that person steal that car? Did they swipe keys off somebody and go steal their car and drive it to the hardware store? Is the hardware store enabling car theft? Are we going to need a VSP login to go to the hardware store now? And again, I'm probably being a little bit over the top and hyperbolic, but in ADA key situations, it could.
Yeah.
In ADA key situations, I truly don't understand why I need to be held to the, you know, highest of standards, but anyone and everyone that runs a hardware store with a key duplicator and a cloning device, they're off the hook. That's anti-competitive in my opinion, right? So let's move forward to the story. I had a, I think it was an 11 Hyundai Sonata, the good old Kia boys, right? Kias and Hyundais are some of the most stolen cars on the planet. Yeah. And this particular Hyundai was just a mechanical key, man. If you could stick a screwdriver in there and break the lock, you could take off in the car. Guy had just bought it, texted me and said, hey, just bought this car, one key. How much would you charge me to make another key? I was at an affordable price. He was happy. We met at a public location. Because I don't have a storefront, I try to, you know, meet people in the middle, literally and figuratively. I meet them in public, open spaces that are well lit, have video cameras, so everyone is on the up and up. He hands me his key. Cut it. I go to the car, turn the key on in the ignition, make sure the car starts, turn the key in the door. It locks and unlocks. Job done. Well, I'm a little bit particular about how I do things, and we all know the ever since you's, right? The since you jobs, ever since you changed my oil, my daughter's pregnant. These people are out there. So every car is getting a pre-scan. I am the Oprah of pre-scans. You get a pre-scan. You get a pre-scan. Everybody's getting a pre-scan. And so I plug my IM608 in this case. It was the first grab. Went to the diag side, scanned the vehicle, and every invoice also has the last date of the VIN number. That way I can keep track of cars, track of customers, et cetera, et cetera. So I look at the VIN number on the B-pillar of the car as well as the door, because on this Hyundai product, it was a little small tag on the door as well as the B-pillar while my scan tool is scanning. I'm trying to be efficient. Look down at the B-pillar. It's all lopsided. There's glue residue. And then they had sliced where the barcode was. And the barcode was partially obstructed by this, you know, obviously defaced VIN number. And I was like, this doesn't add up. So I look at the door tag. It's at a weird angle and you can see glue residue. And I'm like, this is sketchy. So I had handed the guy the key at this point. I'm finishing up his invoice, scanning his car. The job's done. Walk to the front where the windshield is. You couldn't even see the VIN tag. All you could see was glue residue in the edge of the VIN tag where the glue had melted from the summer heat. It was August in Arkansas, okay? And it had sunk down into the dash. You couldn't see it. So I'm like, oh, boy, I don't know what I have just done. You know, I thought I had just made a key to a potentially stolen car. First step, I go into the scan tool, look at my report, look at the VIN number. Two different VINs. The VIN that had been tampered with and was present on the chassis of the vehicle and the VIN that was stored in all the modules. Different VINs.
Okay.
So at this point, I'm sweating bullets. I feel horrible for this guy because either he just got screwed on a potential car purchase where he has a rebuilt title car that's been, you know, welded together and washed, or he's the best poker face car thief out there and he's, you know, playing me a fool. Doubt it because he has a key, but still, anything's possible. Look at the guy and I say, who'd you buy this car from? And started asking and playing the 20 questions game. And everything seemed plausible. Everything added up. The registration he had matched the chassis VIN number. Everything, the bill of sale he showed me, chassis VIN number. Didn't match the ECM VIN number. I'm freaking out. So I get on the NICB database. I think that's National Insurance Crime Bureau. It's a free resource. Anyone can use it. I think it'll let you know if something's a total loss, reported stolen. As a private individual, I don't have access to the car theft database that law enforcement does, but I wanted to do my due diligence to make sure to the best of my ability this thing wasn't stolen. Checked both VINs. Neither of them came back as total loss. Neither of them came back as stolen. So I tell this guy, hey, man, we need to contact the police immediately. And he's like, oh, well, you know, and the job was done. I couldn't hold the guy. I'm not the cops. It's not my job to enforce the law. And I had merely duplicated a key. No different if he had walked into Home Depot and had him cut a metal key. What difference is there? None. I just took that extra step to document the job and document the VIN numbers and cover my own butt. So at this point, customer leaves. I call the local PD. They gave me the runaround, man. I had to spend probably an hour and a half on the phone playing, you know, hold, call this agency, ask the Arkansas State Police, ask this agency. And eventually a detective from the local PD where the job was performed called me. Dude, I thought I was being treated like a car thief, and totally understand they're dealing with, you know, probably major crimes, and VIN tampering is probably not on the top of their list. But I did my due diligence, gave them the customer's contact info, gave them the VIN number, not only reported in the vehicle's modules, but also on the chassis. And I even sent them a picture that I have of the VIN tag being crooked. And I think I might have sent him the pre-scan. He's a police officer. I don't assume that, you know, he's a big car guy. So I did all that and nothing ever happened. I called a friend of mine who is a NASTIF board member, and I was like, dude, I think I'm about to lose my VSP. He's like, what happened? Ran him through the story. He's like, man, you did everything that you could have done. Maybe in the future, do the pre-scan and the VIN verification first, which I probably should have done, but no locksmith license needed. There's no laws saying I can't duplicate a key, and I did no different than your Lowe's or Home Depot would. So very easily, anyone who is busy or sick like I am today, they could walk up to a car like this and try to make a duplicate key and could very well be enabling car theft without realizing it. So that's one of those holes that I think is in this program that could tank people's businesses and could ruin them. So first of all, personal responsibility, you need to do your job. Second of all, things like this have unintended consequences and innocent people are going to be harmed. So that I'll end at that and let you, you know, have a rebuttal or we can continue discussing.
This episode is brought to you by L1 Automotive Training and Keith Perkins. If you're looking for education on module programming, J2534, EEPROM work, key and immobilizer, electrical diagnostics, or drivability diagnostics, Keith has a website, l1training.com, that's got over 60 hours of training videos on all those subjects and more. When I first started out doing mobile, I utilized Keith's videos on module programming and J2534 in order to get my head wrapped around what I would need for the tooling, the computers, the software setups, you know, what kind of obstacles I would be up against when I'm out there programming modules on cars. And it was a huge benefit to me. And I continue to use the training videos that he has on his website. So I strongly recommend checking out l1training.com. The link is in the show notes.
Yeah, no, that website is a great resource. We use that for definitely anything we're doing an all keys loss for. We won't do any of that until we see the title, the identification, the VIN matching the title, and then running it through that registry to make sure that it's not stolen. And luckily, we haven't run into one that's popped up stolen or anything fishy like that. I think the closest I had to that is I was trying to program this wasn't even anti-theft. It was a PCM on a Buick LaCrosse. And I was using the VIN on the door, which the door had just been changed, probably got smashed or something. And I'm like, why is this not working? Well, you got to use the VIN on the car, you dumbass. So I was using the wrong VIN when I was trying to program this thing. But I haven't run into any of the stolen stuff. There's been a few where there's two names on a title and we do require, like, we need both of those identifications. And it's from stories I've heard of, you know, an angry ex spouse trying to, you know, steal a car or something like that. And we try to cover it the best we can, but I very easily can see how you can overlook something, or you, like you say, you're busy, you're overwhelmed. This seems like a very simple job to cut a key for this thing. I mean, look at like a Chevy truck or something, right? You don't even have to do any programming. Just like you say, it's key in, out, key in, you're programmed. Like you programmed a key to that vehicle. And that obviously doesn't require any tooling to do that. And that's every single blade GM for how long is set up that way. So yeah, obviously none of that stuff's going to be, you know, blocked by anything like this. But yeah, keys are definitely an interesting world, man. Have you run into any other like stolen vehicles where it's popped up stolen, or you mentioned like the VIN washing thing? How often do you see that?
Man, I haven't run into anything. I'm very particular about who I do business with. And if I get a text from you, because I try to do a lot of business via text, I'm too busy to talk on the phone all day, and you ask me to do an all keys lost, the first thing out of my mouth is, well, out of my keyboard, I need you to send me a picture of the driver's license cover-up you know, anything you're uncomfortable with sharing, but I need to see your name and that it's a state issued document. And then I need to see some proof of ownership document that's government issued, either title or registration. Again, cover up anything you're uncomfortable with, but at least VIN number and your name. That's not at the end. At the end, I'm going to require those documents because I treat every vehicle like it's a D1 transaction. However, at least all keys lost. However, I understand that people are very wary of giving their personal info up, and I am too. So I try to meet my customers in the middle, but I'm not wasting my time driving out there to find out that this is Billy Bob's car and Billy Bob died 3 weeks ago. And, you know, supposedly he gave it to Jimmy over here and Jimmy's wanting a key made for it. I get those calls all the time. And that's how I pre-qualify the customer before I ever go out there. I say, hey, if you can provide me proof of ownership, you can provide me photo identification, which should technically be a state issued driver's license. At that point, I will put you on the schedule. And just following that one process has pretty well ensured that I've never run into a stolen car. Again, nothing's infallible. There's no such thing as a foolproof plan. But I feel like those steps have washed out any of the, you know, riffraff and junk that I could run into where it's a rebuilt title car and, you know, junk like that you don't want to deal with or somebody's doing something shady. So it's just like when you hear about, I don't want to misquote Lucas. I love Lucas to death, but Lucas talks about like qualifying your customers, I believe, or knowing who your customer is. Like some people's money isn't worth taking because they're going to become the biggest nightmare. And you ask them how much you would have to pay them to get out of your life. So
isn't that the truth?
Yeah. I mean, I've tried to listen to people who even I disagree with. Lucas, I don't necessarily disagree with him. I like his podcast and I've been on it, but I've tried to listen to those things and they've helped me not only business-wise, but that's protected me from dealing with stolen cars and having to talk to the police. Nobody wants to have to talk to the police about a stolen car. So,
right. One of the other like biggest concerns that I saw about this whole thing with NASTIF recently in the like Facebook groups and some other forums and stuff is, and I'm quoting what people are saying here, is that this whole thing is a racket and that it's really about the money and a lot less about what else is being, you know, promoted. And I also have seen like on diag.net, I saw Donnie in there commenting, and from what I can tell, being as genuine as he can, like, hey, this, that is not what this is. What are your feelings on that? I'm not looking to like accuse anybody of anything. I'm curious to bring up these points and talk through them.
Yeah. I mean, first off, let me reiterate, I've met Donnie on multiple occasions. I respect the guy as a person. I think he's a genuinely good dude. I don't think that, you know, he's a lizard person. He's out here to steal people's souls. Okay. There's so much conspiracy. Yeah. Okay. I promise I'm not going to sell anybody supplements tonight, but I would be lying. And anyone that would try to say that they don't have a financial incentive would be lying, right? NASTIF is a nonprofit, but nonprofits still need money to operate. And if you could say force people's hand, that would be in your benefit. And I'm not saying that that's NASTIF's sole reason for doing this. Listen, NASTIF has 100%, I don't think anyone can argue this, has done more good for the industry as a whole. The net change has been good. Okay. Not here to criticize them, not here to attack anyone individually. However, anyone who's like, oh, this isn't about money, they're either lying to themselves or they're lying to you. So this is 100% about the money. Maybe not the same way that they mean it in these Facebook groups where anyone can have a voice. But, I mean, Autel. Let's just talk about Autel. And I don't want to dog them. I use their tools. I have friends that work for Autel. I think that there's a net benefit to using their equipment. But do you think they want to give up the ability to sell tools in the United States if the feds or states were like, oh, you can't sell XYZ in our state and just so happens that Autel's listed? You're crazy. Autel's, air quotes, voluntarily participating because they know that this is a huge market and money is what keeps them in business. So they don't want to lose access to the market. Companies like X-Horse, I love X-Horse equipment. Everybody you know, hates on me because I use my Keytool Max for everything. I don't think that they have a huge market for like the Keytool Plus and my Keytool Max, and I'll be damned if I ever update my Keytool Max. I'll be out here programming everything with the Keytool Max, a space shuttle if I can, because I don't want to have this involved. But the big fish like Autel and Launch, I'm sure, would probably partake, and launch-based tools that are sold under different brands, they want to comply because of money, right? The Chinese government doesn't care. These Chinese entities that share the name that these American companies share, they're not going to follow the rules. You think that Autel China cares? They're probably laughing, rolling on the floor. They don't give a crap about our laws. They break them every day. So, I mean, there's going to be easy ways to bypass this. And I'm not going to give a bunch away because I don't believe in educating thieves. And I will talk to people on an individual basis or in trusted areas. But again, this isn't going to stop anything. It's just going to make Autel tools and launch tools and these big hitters participate in this, you know, sham as I see it, because they don't want to lose access. And don't get me wrong, I think that NASTIF is genuinely wanting to solve the tool and car theft problem. I don't think that this was solely like, oh, we want to make money from DSP applications. I don't think that's it. But we would be disingenuous to say that there is no financial incentive that NASTIF has for this to roll out, because everyone has an IM608 at this point. The trunk slammers, the professional shops, the mobile guys like me, everyone's got one. And if you, you know, if you don't want your tool held hostage, guess what? You got to pay the ransom. So, again, not attempting to personally attack any individual, but there's financial incentives. Follow the money. Everyone has money in at stake in this process, and that's probably what's driving this. In my opinion, again, please don't think that I'm some infallible person.
No, I appreciate you being honest with your opinion. You know, and I don't think anyone on either side of the table could deny that they've got a stack of applications in the last couple weeks that they may have never seen before. Okay, that's true for sure, right? But now, okay, they've got to handle all of those new applications that get approved, they'll process them, and then handle all those people that are now VSPs in one fashion or another. So yeah, obviously there's going to be, you know, some more resources. Now on the company side of things, I could definitely see what you're saying there, is that they're playing the game so that they could still sell their tools where they're making a bunch of money right now. I mean, why wouldn't you as a business owner, if that's the steps you got to make? Like if somebody, I mean, I guess that's kind of sort of what this is, you know, like if somebody said, hey, you want to keep doing your business here, Sean, you need to join this club, do this thing, pay this money. Okay. Hey, it's reasonable. Cool. I'll do this. I'll jump on board with this group or sign up for this thing so that I can still make money and run my business the way that I've been doing it. Yeah. Well, why wouldn't you? I mean, depending on what it is, but I hear what you're saying there.
Yeah. And I'm trying to play the middle as best I can. And like I said at the beginning, we all have an agenda. Like, I'm lazy. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have to every single add a key, be like, hey, show me an ID, show me a registration. The customers just won't. They'll just go somewhere else. They'll go to the dude who doesn't have a VSP at risk because he's doing all the cheap, easy keys on, you know, the gravy work that I would really appreciate to have. And those trunk slammers, as we like to call them in the locksmith world, they're just going to keep slamming their trunk and going and making cheap, easy keys. And
yeah,
easy does it. Easy money.
Yeah, and there'll be a whole new slew of tools that'll get around things in different ways. I know that's not going to stop either. It'll just be, you know, some other Chinese or foreign brand of something that does bypasses something in some new way. That's going to be out there for sure.
I don't want to get sidetracked too much. We've hit almost every point, I think, except for like title washing, which it's kind of irrelevant. I did want to talk about security through obscurity in the locksmith industry and how I feel like it shot itself in the foot.
Okay.
I don't know if that's something you want to talk about, and this is your podcast, so you lead the way,
Let's hear it. What do you got?
Well, I am very tight-lipped about making keys. I'm not going to, you know, give an instructional video on YouTube. I'm not going to teach a customer how I'm making their keys, but I don't care if they watch. There's a sense of anxiety around anything security related, your home security, your, you know, your car, and being open and transparent is a way to educate people. If people truly understood how things worked and the security flaws, we would probably see a lot tighter security, right? That phrase security through obscurity, it gets thrown around a lot. And this YouTube channel I'm going to mention is very well hated by many in the locksmith community. And I don't see why, but the Lockpicking Lawyer, I think, has done a great service to the security industry because, one, he's showing the world how flawed a lot of locks are.
Sure.
If people didn't understand that you can pop a, you know, a master lock open with two hammers, if they don't understand that, they're just going to start putting everything behind a master lock and woo, your boat just got stolen because you used a crappy master lock on your gate at your house. I mean,
yeah. Once I started using Leashy, I gave me a whole new like thought process of how vulnerable my car is. I'm like, oh, it was that easy. Like, I mean, not all of them. Some of them kick my ass and it took me a while, but like some of them are really freaking easy to get into the car through a lock. And I'm like, well, it's not as secure as I thought it was.
Yeah. And security through obscurity, the locksmith trade, I feel like I was very lucky because I was baptized by fire. I got dropped right in with Brad and we just hit the ground running, man. Like European cars is what I started learning locksmithing on. So okay. Everything has a high security key. Almost every job we did involved some level of EEPROM or more advanced tool than just an IM608. And that's great, but I mean, it was still a fairly easy task if you had the right equipment, right? And hiding this behind closed doors, it does serve a purpose. You don't want to devalue your trade, right? Trade secrets are critical to keep secret. But if we don't educate customers and we don't educate the industry about security flaws, they will continue to exist. And that's why I'm so anti-security through obscurity. And let's be real. It's already out there, man. Everyone on YouTube's making key videos. It's the hot thing, right? There's a guy that makes them. I'm not trying to speak negatively about any person because I'm sure he's another honest guy, just like the rest of us trying to make money. My Keys Automotive. That dude is giving out step-by-step instructional videos. Oh, you buy an IM608.
Multilingual, too.
Yeah, and he does put out Spanish videos. And I'm married to a first-generation American. I'm glad that he is giving a resource to people who may not speak English. That's great. But he's probably telling people a little too much. A simple demonstration of this is how easy it is to break into someone's car. Pick a lock.
Yeah.
Take all your valuables out of your vehicle. I think a really common theft in my area, because of the environment I live in and the views of people where I live, gun thefts are very common. People leave their firearms in their cars. That's irresponsible and unsafe. And if people understood how vulnerable they were, not just a brick. I mean, all it takes is a brick, knock your window out, boom, free Glock. And quit putting Glock Perfection stickers on the back of your tan Toyota Tacoma. That's a free gun sticker. I mean, seriously, if people aren't aware that what they're doing is so reckless, they're going to continue to do it. And then the counter argument is we all understand how dumb it is to text and drive. But every day when I drive down the road, every single person staring at their phone, not looking at the road. But the few people who didn't know and who then are informed that make the changes, that's worth it in my opinion. So the security through obscurity stuff that the locksmith industry clings to with, you know, almost violent tendencies. I mean, I have heard rants like, I wish I could meet the guy who made that video. I'd beat him to death. I understand being upset about, you know, losing your livelihood and so much competition that the market is devalued to a point that no one who runs a legitimate business can make money. But there's got to be a middle ground, man. We can't have the security through obscurity guys that are going to rule it by here's the little Wizard of Oz curtain. We're going to pull it back just to show you because you're a part of the team. Oh, close it real quick before the customer sees. And we can't be the dude putting YouTube videos out like, hey, this is how you steal a Hellcat. You pull this panel off and here's these connectors and you stick these two needles in here and woo, check it out. Plug in a KM100, vroom, take off in a minute. So we have to find a balance and we need to probably self-police. I mean, heck, the other day, a good friend of mine posted a picture of a BMW that he was working on. I think he did like a used CAS 3 module that he cloned over, but he ended up posting a picture on Facebook with a VIN number and an ISN. So I jokingly commented, hey, what's the address of this car? I'd love to come visit it, because that's all you need to steal it at that point. I mean, it's a pretty easy job. He did the work for me. Right. So stuff like that is where you cross a line. And I feel like the locksmith industry, through complacency, and clinging to this security through obscurity mindset, they have painted themselves in a corner. And that's not just the locksmith industry, it's car brands too. Like, look at Chrysler. How easy is it to steal a Chrysler? I would love to go to the local PDs around me with a KM100 and every Dodge Chrysler that they have, just make keys for them. Here, this is my public service to the community. I'm making you all free keys, but look how easy it is. And just bam, 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 bam. And showing them what these tools look like so that the regular beat cop knows what to look for, right? But I feel like I'm just speaking into the wind because everybody's got their camp and they're stuck in it and they don't want to listen.
Yeah. And you're right about the locksmith thing. That stuff is, there's gatekeepers to it. And even with the module stuff, although you've seen some of that been getting out into classes and things like that. And like you say, there's both sides of the table, because I've said before, if the thing that you do is only valuable because you can keep it a secret, it's not really that valuable. Like, if somebody just saw how you did it, oh, then now they can do it. Like, is it really that valuable? But yeah, should you be posting how to do all keys lost on YouTube for free for anybody to watch with tools that they can go on Amazon and buy? Probably not. That's, you might want to rethink what you're doing there for sure. And I've tried to, like, personally keep like security related key stuff out of the content that I produce for that reason, not because I'm trying to keep it a secret from everybody, but that, hey, you know, some of this stuff is sensitive. And I go, going back to NAS stuff, like, there should be at least some sort of vetting process in some way, however it's done, and you know, whatever it looks like. Yeah, like, the professionals should hopefully be the ones doing these types of jobs and sharing this information with each other. I mean, that's why chat groups are good for the most part. You know, some of that information you can keep off of like a public database anyways, or semi-public database. But yeah, it's, you do want to be careful. Yeah, you don't want to put like a pin code in a VIN, or ISN and a VIN number, or I even go this far. So like, if I take pictures of the keys that I make, right, and I put it in the invoice, and like, here's the key that I made. I'll cover up the blade just in case I have like a major data leak. Like, I might have the customer's name, address, the VIN number, the car, maybe the license plate, and oh, there's the cuts for the key too, that, you know, they could just go make a key for it. So I try to think about that stuff too. Like, how can I be more secure in the data that I'm storing in my system? Cause you never know what, you know, with the data leak or something like that, what they could get from these vehicles.
Yeah. And I mean, just to try to summarize it and come back to the point, because my rants and opinions are worth exactly what all your listeners are paying for them, which is nothing. Realistically speaking, all we're doing is putting a very, very short barrier in front of thieves before they get to cars. I got to talk to Donnie at Vision, and I jokingly said, what's next, a VSP login to buy a rollback truck to tow cars with? Because I mean, what's stopping thieves from social engineering a tow truck driver going out and buy their own? I mean, these car theft operations are probably not little individuals. They're probably someone recruited that's maybe in a gang, or in a situation where they can be influenced, and they say, hey, take this tool, take this key, go over this car, let me show you how this works, and then for every car you do this to, I'm going to pay you like $500,000, whatever. So the little guy goes out and steals the car, and he brings it to the the big operation, right? Where the people that are really involved in the, you know, the top levels of car theft and, you know, chop shopping and things, what's stopping them from, oh, well, I can't use a KM100. I'll just go get a Kodiak Chevy Kodiak, or GMC Kodiak, whatever. I'm going to go get a rollback truck. I'm just going to roll around neighborhoods until I find a Hellcat or a Challenger and roll up. Who's going to think anything of it? You know, it's a tow truck. Maybe he's got car problems. It is a Dodge. So, I mean, realistically speaking, it's easy. Heck, if I was a car thief, I'd probably take that route. If you look at social engineering, wear a reflective vest, a hard hat, and carry a clipboard, you can get into anywhere. Man, I thought, I just knew that when I started this, I was going to have to deal with the cops every week. I just knew it. Man, I've done all keys lost on cars after dark in parking lots with lots of people around. You know how sketchy it is for you to walk up to a car with a leashy yes. and a thing of spray lube and I'm just picking away and the cops have never shown up. So if you've got a, you know, yellow flashing lights and you've been casing the joint, you know, when they're away from home because people don't have good OPSEC and they're, oh, we're going on vacation the 25th and you leave your Hellcat in your driveway. Oh, well, Tim, you know, he's been my next door neighbor. I knew he went on vacation. I bet he's getting his car worked on. Okay. And that person rolls up, beep, pulls the car. It's gone. And now that Hellcat is going to get taken to a chop shop and, hey, we found this, you know, wrecked police V6 Charger or whatever. It's burned out to the ground. We're going to buy it from Copart. They buy it from Copart and drill bits and peeling labels. And man, my Hellcat has a V6 in it now. I mean, I may be being hyperbolic, but I mean, VIN washing and title fraud, this stuff happens, man. And sure. These big fish are not going to be stopped by this. I mean, all it takes is a rollback truck. Signal boosters. How many videos have you seen on YouTube? A guy runs up to someone's door and he's got this weird looking dish and he holds it up to their door. And then there's another guy standing right next to the car holding another device. And he gets the passive entry because you're boosting that proximity signal, jumps in the car, hits the push button, start, vroom, gone. Are we going to start selling VSPs to people who sell signal boosters? Like, what? I mean, this is a slippery slope fallacy, and maybe I'm just an idiot who doesn't know what they're talking about, but truly and honestly, it's a joke to call this a car theft preventative. All it's going to do is slow people down, and it's probably not going to slow them down as much as people think.
Well, all I can say on that is I don't think that whatever organization it is, NASTIF or whatever, should do less or do nothing because these people are still going to continue to steal cars or do whatever bad things that they're doing, right? Obviously, yes, they are going to figure out different ways to do it, and they're going to continue to operate in that manner. But I don't buy into the argument that that means that, well, there's no point in doing this, right? Now, how it's handled in the details, sure, I'm open to discussion on that. And like I said, I'm probably not the qualified person to make the decisions on exactly what is the best and how it's the most effective. But I hope that as time progresses, what NASTIF or a group like NASTIF is capable of doing to help prevent this, they do pursue and continue to do. Now, again, like we mentioned too, they're limited, right? A lot of this falls on law enforcement. There's only so much, you know, that we can do. We can do our stuff on our end to be secure, and hopefully NASA's doing what they can do, and then as law enforcement. But I hope that none of those groups of people, whether it be the VSPs, the people programming keys, or NASA for law enforcement, just decides, oh, well, you know, they're still going to do it, so well, we might as well not really put, you know, the efforts towards safeguarding this stuff. Or, you know, the I heard the argument of like, well, now carjackings are going to go up, so it's making, you know, people more vulnerable. And I don't buy into the let's not pursue safeguarding this stuff because we're scared that this might happen. In, you know, that's the reciprocation to this. I don't buy into that, I guess. That's my one thing on that.
Well, I respect you, and I think that you're an intelligent person. I think you're mostly right. I do personally think that carjackings will go up. It all goes down to incentives, right? Why do people steal cars? There's money to be made. Why do people get social engineered or recruited to steal cars? They're in a bad economic situation. They don't have another, they don't see another way out. We have to fix the problem, not the symptom. And this is very much, it feels to me like it's a symptom fix. It's, oh, people are using an IM608 to steal cars. Let's make it harder to use an IM608. And I don't get to control this. I'm never going to be able to make this change not occur, but it comes down to the end user. Guys, there's so many tools out there that you can buy that are not going to comply with this. It's not going to slow me down in my business. I'm just going to have a preference for a different tool. And there will be a time where I'll have to use the IM608 or do a D1, and those times will still exist. But I just feel like it's wishful thinking.
Well, like I said, I appreciate being honest, and I think it's important to get everybody's opinions and perspective out there, especially if they're willing to be, you know, respectful like you are and talk this out. And, you know, there's no, you haven't called me any names or anything like that. So I appreciate you coming on and talking about this stuff.
I appreciate you just giving me a chance to speak out, because I'm sure there's a lot of people that are on my side of things, right? They're very much in the middle on it, and they're pissed. They're upset, and they don't feel like anyone's listening to them. I don't feel like I'm being listened to, but at least you gave this side of the argument a voice, and maybe we can, you know, interact with NASTIF and fix bugs and say, hey, look, this is a problem. And I truly believe NASTIF will try to listen, and there might be some changes made, but it just is what it is. So it's in the end user's court now. Decide how you're going to do it. Join the dark side and do everything EEPROM, or keep using your IM608. It's your choice.
I like doing EEPROM, so.
Me too, man. I will do anything to avoid a D1, so I'll be out there EEPROMing anything and everything I can do without having to do the IM608 or the D1 form.
Cool, man. Well, thank you for spending the time with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, man.
All right, that's going to do it for today's episode. I want to give another big thank you to Zach for joining me on the show. Really appreciate it. Always good to talk to him. Hopefully you enjoyed that as well. Right, this episode and last week's episode, maybe you're on one side of the fence or the other. Maybe you don't agree with everything that's been said on either episode. But let me know what your thoughts are. Obviously, you know, as respectfully and intelligently as possible. But go ahead and put some stuff in the Facebook group, reach out. Always curious to hear everyone's different perspectives. That's how we improve. So anyways, thank you so much for listening. Really appreciate it. And let's get out there, start fixing the world one car at a time.